Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're really digging into one of the most persistent crime legends, maybe, of the late 20th century.
That's right. It's a story that, well, it almost instantly got coded into the public mind in a very specific way.
It swapped this sort of innocent world of fairy tales for the much darker reality of armed syndicates, drug paranoia. It's quite the contrast.
Exactly. We often start these analyses by looking at the source myth, the original folklore.
And here we start with Snow White, don't we? A tale we all know, innocence, exile, a woman needing rescue. Pretty straightforward.
But the figure we're focusing on today, the woman at the heart of this infamous 1978 police raid, she took that exact fairy tale.
Co-opted it.
Completely. Co-opted the trope, twisted it, and turned it into this incredibly sophisticated mechanism of control. Strategic, absolute control.
So our mission today for you listening is really to get past that front page story, the immediate tragedy narrative.
We're comparing the legend, the fabricated story of this helpless captive against the cold, hard, observed documentation, the records that reveal her actual role.
Which was?
The ruler, the architect. We need to unpack what happens when that traditional victim role isn't just endured, but it's deliberately weaponized.
Turning a fairy tale into a power play.
The ultimate power play.
Okay, so the initial reports, the ones that shaped the legend, they painted this really vivid picture, didn't they? Seven armed men.
Right.
A woman seen as fragile, helpless, a captive.
The classic damsel in distress setup.
And then this bizarre detail, almost theatrical, the calling card involving an apple. Like, something straight out of the story.
Yes, that motif is critical.
So our deep dive today is focused entirely on the source material that came out of that raid, out of that flat.
And these sources, they just dismantle the legend piece by piece.
Revealing this figure who wasn't named conventionally in the operation's own records, she was marked simply as Queen.
And that contradiction, that specific point, the public face, the hostage versus the internal record, the Queen, that's where the real insight is hiding.
Right. So for you, the goal is to get that knowledge quickly, but really thoroughly, to find that aha moment.
Exactly. And it's not in the drugs seized or the guns counted. It's buried deep in the contradictory evidence about who she really was and what she was actually doing.
Okay, let's set the scene then. The raid itself. Let's unpack the setting first. The raid itself. 1978. A nondescript flat, cramped quarters.
Yeah, not exactly a palace, which makes the tension, the atmosphere, even more intense, right? Close confines.
Reports detail seven men inside. All heavily armed, you mentioned paranoia, and surrounded by just quantities of white powder, cocaine.
The whole environment was just saturated with it. Anxiety, chemical residue. It's palpable even in the reports.
And that paranoia, you said it was crucial. How so?
Well, the specifics really matter for understanding the power dynamics later. They hadn't just, you know, locked the door.
Yeah.
Reports indicate they had set up internal security. Think barricades, tripwires, even crude surveillance watching the hallway outside their floor.
Wow. So a real siege mentality.
Absolutely. Living in a constant state of high alert. And right in the middle of all this, this armed, paranoid, high-risk situation, there she was.
And the initial perception, the visual that the first officers documented, that's what really cemented the legend. What were those specifics? What made them see victim?
Okay, so she was reported as being young, around 20, her skin. The descriptions use terms like porcelain.
Suggesting fragility. Paleness.
Exactly. That classic image of someone vulnerable, totally out of place in that kind of violent, chaotic scene. And crucially, her eyes were glazed.
Drugs.
Likely extensive drug use, yes. And she was silent. Absolutely. Almost catatonically silent.
So that visual, the silent, still fragile-looking young woman, it just immediately became the narrative.
The innocent captive just trying to survive the chaos around her. It fit perfectly.
That silence, that passivity, it framed the whole story for the media, didn't it? But the sources, they give us something immediately, something physical that cracks that image.
Yes. There's a detail that complicates the pure victim narrative right away.
Was there physical evidence on her that contradicted that?
There was. And it's specific. Telling. The police report noted it with precision. It wasn't just that white powder was near her.
Yeah.
Reports confirmed it was smudged beneath her nose.
Oh, that's
a single image. Porcelain skin, and then the residue of the very product they were dealing or using. It just fractures that clean narrative of the innocent bystander.
It suggests involvement, intimacy with the scene, not just being trapped within it.
Definitely not distant captivity.
Okay, so that detail introduces complexity. But the men themselves, they actively helped build the legend, didn't they? when the police questioned them, or even before.
Oh, absolutely. They moved fast to define her role for the police, to paint her as peripheral.
How did they describe her?
Emphatically. They called her nothing. They insisted she was just a stray, maybe someone transient who owed debts, or perhaps a low-level runner.
Classic deflection.
Textbook syndicate deflection, especially when a powerful woman might be involved. The instinct is always to minimize her, define her as insignificant, maybe just beholden to the men.
So there's this immediate mismatch. What the men were doing, being heavily armed around her, maybe protecting her, maybe controlling her, versus what they were saying.
Precisely.
Psychologically, why was it so important for them to insist she was just a hostage or a stray? What did that narrative do for them?
Well, it served multiple purposes, right? Immediately. First, legally, it simplifies things for the police, potentially.
How so?
If she's just a hostage, police might focus elsewhere, looking for the real leader, the men in charge. But deeper than that, it let the men cling to the illusion of their own control.
Even as the police are literally breaking down their door.
Especially then. It preserves their internal status, perhaps.
So it comes down to this dynamic you mentioned, hostage versus architect.
Yeah.
It's a psychological battle as much as a legal or a criminal one.
Absolutely.
Why would these armed, paranoid men need to believe they were protecting a hostage?
Because a hostage needs protection. A hostage inspires pity, maybe even a certain kind of deference. These are roles that let the men maintain their own sense of power, their definition of masculinity within that group.
They get to be the strong ones, the guardians.
Exactly. An architect, though, a ruler, that requires obedience, that generates fear, and that's a much more dangerous reality to admit, especially to the authorities, maybe even to themselves.
So they invested in the Snow White myth because it made them feel powerful?
Plausibly, yes. Even if, underneath it all, they were terrified of the situation they were in.
And reports do confirm she maintained that visual posture. Silent, still, appearing terrified, at least during those initial moments of the raid.
Yes, that initial appearance was key. It became the foundation of the public legend.
And the most effective guardrail they all used against immediate scrutiny from the police.
It sold the story. But that posture, the one that made the headlines, it dissolved completely when you look closer.
That the objective evidence recovered from the flat.
Exactly. The posture was strategic, a disguise. The paperwork, the source material, that told a very different story, uncorrupted by fear or narrative bias.
Okay, let's pivot then. From the immediate chaotic visual evidence to the structured operational evidence inside that flat.
Right, paperwork.
Despite the drugs, the paranoia, you said the men kept meticulous ledgers. What did the state of those documents tell us?
They were incredibly revealing. They documented payouts, names, specific codes for transactions, inventory, just really detailed records.
And the physical state.
Well, the image we get from the sources is striking. These were truly powdered ledger pages.
Literally covered in the cocaine residues.
Tangible evidence of the environment, yes. Found scattered amidst the powder, the residue of the product. Yet inside, they contained cold, hard facts about the syndicate's financial structure.
So, contaminated by the scene, but the data itself was intact.
Precisely. Which is remarkable in itself.
And this is where we move past testimony, past the physical residue to the structural evidence, because those pages contained the core contradiction, the undeniable proof against the stray narrative.
Yes. What was found next to her transactions, her allocations?
What was that singular, consistent mark?
In every list, names, codes, payments relating to significant movements of funds, of product, there was one word consistently used.
The word was
queen.
Queen. Not a street name, not a term of endearment.
No, not in the context of these operational ledgers. These weren't love letters. They tracked the flow of money and command. In that context, queen means authority. It signifies rank, structural command.
It's an undeniable title, embedded right there in their own internal accounting system.
It completely dismantles the men's story that she was nothing.
It confirms that within their own operational rules, she wasn't peripheral. She was the axis.
We really need to pause and think about the significance of that single word. In a criminal record, titles are the currency.
They dictate everything.
Cash flow, hierarchy, decision-making power. Her designation was one of command, meticulously documented, even as her supposed dwarves were verbally denying she even mattered.
It connects to themes we track, doesn't it?
Yeah.
In our internal registry, the Inspector Story Index.
Yes, this ties directly into a critical theme. Erasure and identity.
Can you expand on that? How does this specific detail link to those broader ISI themes?
Absolutely. If we look at the broader picture of strategic identity management in these kinds of organizations, there's a really striking parallel. Think about the case of Klaus Richter, the one known as Der Schatten, the Shadow.
Richter, the one whose organization went to massive lengths to erase him from official records after he was gone.
Exactly, a shadowy military entity, or something close to it. They expended enormous effort to delete him, wiped him from the files.
So in Richter's case, the evidence of his power was paradoxically the erasure itself. The effort involved proved how important he must have been.
Precisely. Richter's deletion became the proof. The only real proof that he existed and was powerful enough to require that level of systemic erasure.
And how does that parallel connect back to our queen?
Well, in her case, the men were attempting a verbal erasure during the raid, calling her nothing, defining her as disposable, trying to make her disappear from the immediate narrative.
But the record resisted.
The record resisted that erasure. And her own strategic silence, her refusal to be named or defined during those chaotic moments, it only served to amplify the power of the title already marked in the ledger.
The paper evidence flatly contradicted the denials.
She didn't need to speak. The bookkeeping, the accounts, they spoke volumes for her.
So this confirms her power wasn't just, you know, charisma or implied influence. It was structural, foundational to their finances.
Right. The ledgers show she was central to the accounting, the system, the internal hierarchy of who got paid what, who controlled the inventory.
Which implies the whole operation, down to the last drug code, probably required her involvement, or at least her sign-off.
It strongly suggests it. The title Queen wasn't decorative. It was evidence of command, hidden right there in the most mundane yet crucial part of their business. The receipts, the account.
And the meticulousness of those records.
Yeah.
That's the final nail in the coffin for the stray narrative.
It really is. Paranoia, heavy drug use that often leads to operational chaos, sloppy records. But these were apparently clear, detailed.
Suggesting a controlling hand somewhere.
It suggests that while the men might have handled the muscle, the external risk, the queen managed the architecture of the business, ensuring its structural integrity through information control.
Okay, so accepting her role as queen, the whole narrative flips, doesn't it? From defensive hostage to active architect.
Completely.
And the source material, it actually details how she controlled things.
Mm-hmm.
And what's really striking is the methods were unconventional.
Extremely. She carried no weapon, apparently. Didn't rely on overt physical threats.
So where did the power come from?
Pure intelligence, information, and psychological warfare.
Information as a weapon.
Her expertise, the sources emphasize, was terrifying. She knew everything. Every shipment schedule, every specific payoff amount, and most critically, every financial secret, every vulnerability of every single person involved in that operation.
Wow. In an organization built on suspicion, fear, secrecy, knowing everything about everyone.
It's the ultimate weapon. And it's non-lethal in a direct sense. Information became her blade. Silence was her shield.
And this knowledge, it created a dynamic, a psychological hold far stronger than any physical chain.
Yes. The sources capture this loyalty dynamic with, well, brutal clarity. There's an observation that really defines the nature of her control over those men.
What was that observation?
The sources state, each man believed he was her protector. Each one was her P.
Chilling. That's incredibly stark.
It is. She didn't demand loyalty through the usual threats, fear of execution. She weaponized their desire to protect her, that instinct to guard the vulnerable Snow White figure. She used it like an unbreakable chain.
So this is where the fairy tale isn't just camouflage anymore. It's the actual mechanism of manipulation.
Brilliant psychological manipulation. She created a scenario where these armed, dangerous, paranoid men saw themselves as the heroes, the strong ones.
By adopting that posture, the beautiful, silent captive, she convinced them their power was needed to protect her innocence.
Securing their total, often self-sacrificial devotion in the process.
It's incredible, but this obedience, it wasn't just assumed, was it? It had to be enforced somehow.
Right, and this brings us to that really shocking incident, the calling card motif you mentioned earlier. It details what happened to the one man who apparently tried to defy the system, the deserter.
The one who tried to leave the organization.
Yes. The story goes, he was later found foaming at the mouth in a bathtub.
Clearly an enforcement hit. A message to the others, betrayal isn't tolerated.
Swift and brutal. But the centerpiece of the scene, the grim theatricality, it was the object found clutched in his hand.
The apple.
Yes. We've image three here for you. An apple bitten clean through, just resting there in the dead man's hand.
Terrifying. In its simplicity and its effectiveness.
This is the moment the legend stopped being just camouflage and started serving a very practical, operational function.
It becomes an internal syndicate message.
Using the precise language of the folklore they were already steeped in to generate immediate visceral terror. If the queen is Snow White and you betray her,
The penalty is swift, symbolic death, the poison fruit.
the myth itself becomes the executioner's signature, a warning sign written in their own coded language.
It's pure psychological warfare, so efficient. The other men wouldn't just see a body, they'd see a prophecy fulfilled.
Exactly. The apple confirmed to them that challenging her authority wasn't just dangerous, it was like challenging fate, or at least challenging the unwritten, predetermined laws of their world.
She didn't have to orchestrate complex plans for that message. The myth she'd cultivated did the work for her. It dictated the message, the fear.
This level of theatrical control just reinforces the profound agency she possessed. It wasn't the men ruling through chaos and violence, it was her, ruling through narrative control and symbolic fear.
She was the one writing the internal laws.
Yes.
And her command over her own narrative, her own story, it was fully on display later, wasn't it? During the police interrogation?
Oh, absolutely. The authorities may be still influenced by that initial hostage image.
Yeah.
They tried to solidify it. Standard questioning.
Trying to get her to confirm her role as a victim.
Presumably, trying to fit her into the box they'd already built. But her response,
She maintained the silence.
the strategic silence continued, yes, but it was punctuated by this gesture, a look that revealed her true perspective.
What did she do?
The sources describe her simply looking up from the interrogation table and offering this quiet smile at questioning, just looking at them.
A smile. That's unnerving.
It's the smile of someone completely in control. Someone who knows the questioners are playing a different game entirely, steps behind the reality she inhabits. It's almost contempt, but delivered with poise.
And then she spoke. A direct quote that just cut through everything.
Yes, fairy tales are for children, she whispered. That's the declaration of authorship, isn't it? She's not just denying the story they want to hear. She's saying, I built this story, I deployed it, I used it to manipulate everyone.
The men, the public, maybe even the police sitting right in front of her.
She wasn't the captive of the fairy tale. She was its sovereign ruler, declaring it right there.
Okay, let's pull back now. Broaden the context. Connect these threads, system control, false narratives, back to our Inspector Story Index work.
Right, because this case is just a stunning example of how structural power works, even without overt physical force being the primary tool.
Her use of ledgers, the internal structure, it reminds me of lessons from other files.
Absolutely. When we analyze how she used those systems, the accounting, the rules to wield power, it provides a really clear analog to what we learned from the ISI file on Monopoly, specifically the collector.
Ah, right. The idea that the system itself, the rules of engagement, is the ultimate boss, not the individuals who think they're running things.
Exactly. And the specific takeaway we distilled from that case was, from Monopoly, the game trains you before it pays you.
Okay, how does that apply here to the Queen and her syndicate?
Well, these men weren't just operating in some kind of chaotic free-for-all. They were participants in a meticulously organized financial system, a system she either designed or, at the very least, expertly exploited.
So they were being trained by her rules.
Trained by the rules she established, yes. Rules of debt, loyalty, payout schedules. They believed they were just earning their cut, playing the game.
But in reality,
In reality, they were pieces moving on her board, bound by her structural law, and bound by the constant existential threat of challenging her authority, symbolized by that bitten apple.
she made sure the system, the architecture itself, was loyal to her, regardless of the men's loyalties to each other.
Precisely. The structure served her purpose.
And her ability to manipulate perception, an incredibly effective hostage front. That ties into another ISI case, doesn't it? The danger of trusting outward appearances.
Yes, very strongly. It relates directly to the lessons from Aladdin, the case file on Adil al-Din.
And the principle there was.
As Aladdin showed, the treasure is usually a trap.
Okay, explain that connection.
The men believed they possessed the ultimate treasure, didn't they? This silent, beautiful, protected Snow White. This rare asset that somehow set their operation apart, made them special protectors.
But they were the ones trapped.
They were the ones trapped by their loyalty to that image, by their need to protect the treasure.
The irony is just thick.
Yeah.
Seeing themselves as protectors of the treasure while functionally guarding their own cage.
Exactly. She was the bait, the perfect false front. the psychological scapegoat, ready to be deployed if the police ever break through.
Yet, at the same time,
simultaneously, she was the one pulling every significant financial and organizational string, managing perception, directing threats away from herself, while maintaining absolute control over the money and the rules.
This analysis really brings home the critical application for you, the listener. It's about agency. Agency even when circumstances seem overwhelming.
Right. The men had the guns, the visible power, the paranoia driving them. But she demonstrated superior agency.
Through intelligence? Strategic silence.
This whole case study just proves it. Knowledge, the control of information, knowing every shipment, every payoff, every secret that is the ultimate source of power.
And it's often hidden, right there in plain sight, maybe in a powdered ledger page, but far more potent than any visible weapon.
She was a master of what we could call narrative engineering. She understood, instinctively or deliberately, that if you control the story people tell themselves about you, you control their actions.
The men were too dizzy playing protectors in the Snow White myth
to realize the queen was managing the entire kingdom right under their noses. She used the expected cultural script, the script of female victimhood, as her greatest shield, her greatest asset.
So that final analysis then on hostage versus architect, It's profound. She didn't just break the legend by suddenly revealing her power.
No, that would have been crude. Too risky. She was far more strategic.
She hijacked it.
Hijacked it. Use the established fairy tale as flawless camouflage for her real role, the ruler. She let the police, the public, even her own men, see exactly what they expected or needed to see a victim.
While covertly running the entire show, all documented in those powdered ledger pages.
Mm-hmm.
Incredible. Hashtag tag tag outro.
So we started this deep dive thinking about that media image, didn't we? The helpless captive, the porcelain skin.
And we end with a very different understanding. A strategic ruler. Power found not in force, but in ledgers, in psychology, in the deliberate weaponization of silence.
We watched the narrative transform completely, from the tragic Snow White figure to the highly calculated queen.
Her ultimate defense wasn't an alibi or denial. It was the story she engineered for everyone else to believe, including her own armed crew.
So picture her again, seated at that interrogation table, that quiet smile fading, leaving behind only the cold, clear perspective of the author. The author of the entire situation, not the captive within it.
That's the final image. The author, not the captive.
And that really is the ultimate takeaway. The thought we want to leave you with to mull over. She didn't break the spell, she wrote it.
A perfect way to put it. Control is often most powerful when it's woven right into the silence itself. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive into the sources.
We look forward to the next time.